From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in today for Terry Gross. On today's show, Marching in Place, the status quo presidency of George Bush. Journalist Michael Duffy covers the White House for Time magazine. He says President Bush has set no real national priorities during his term, trying to do as little as possible and still get reelected in 1992. And composer John Cage has died at the age of 79. We'll listen back to a conversation between John Cage and Terry Gross. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews American Mythologies, an investigation of the living sources of the American myth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that Secretary of State James Baker will leave his post to run the White House. Despite his new title, Baker will try to get the president's reelection effort back on track. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The announcement that Baker will take the reins of the campaign has been expected for months, despite the Secretary of State's reported reluctance to leave the rarefied world of diplomacy. But with Mr. Bush trailing his Democratic challenger Bill Clinton in most opinion polls, many Republicans have been almost desperate to have Baker, a fabled campaign strategist, take over. Baker has been involved in the campaigns of Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, in addition to overseeing Mr. Bush's landslide victory 4 years ago. The president said this morning that Baker will oversee a new effort to set the administration's goals for the next 4 years.
He will help me build on what we've started by developing an integrated second-term program of domestic, economic, and foreign policies.
Baker will replace current Chief of Staff Samuel Skinner, who will in turn move to a top Republican Party post. I'm Andy Bowers at the White House.
Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton condemned President Bush today in those policy areas where the president is generally considered to be strongest, foreign and military affairs. Clinton charged that instead of encouraging democracies, the president has coddled repressive regimes, including China and South Africa. He also accused the president of maintaining what he called an obliging silence on Iraq's human rights record before the invasion of Kuwait. Clinton launched the attack in a speech before the World Affairs Council in Los Angeles. Afghan defense officials say Kabul was hit by a rocket attack early this morning. At least 80 people were killed and 150 were wounded. One official blamed the attack on the forces of fundamentalist leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. From Kabul, the BBC's Susie Price reports.
The silence over the city is unnerving. People appear to be waiting in their homes, tensed for the next boom and whistle heralding the arrival of a rocket. The attack on the center of town this morning was one of the most horrific scenes in the escalating violence over the past few months. The bodies were brought to one hospital piled in a bus. The rockets, which landed in the crowded street near the General Post Office, apparently included a missile with cluster explosives, which scattered over a wide area. An hour later, there were still pools of blood on the pavement and bloody footprints leading down into a subway where the injured had tried to shelter from the continuing shelling. The attack was discussed by ministers and high-level commanders at a meeting at the Ministry of Defense. They condemned the rocketing and ordered the ministers of health, housing, and related areas to take urgent action.
Susie Price reporting. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,313. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The UN Security Council voted today to authorize the use of all measures necessary to deliver humanitarian aid to Bosnia. The resolution would permit the use of military force as a last resort to protect the delivery of relief supplies. In a second vote, the 15-member council adopted another resolution that condemns any violation of international humanitarian law, including those involved in the practice of ethnic cleansing. The statement demanded immediate, unimpeded, and continuous access by the Red Cross to all detention camps in the former Yugoslavia. Federal authorities in New York indicted fugitive Colombian drug boss Pablo Escobar and his alleged top assassin for blowing up an Avianca Airlines plane 3 years ago. 110 people were killed. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchliffe reports.
The 14-count indictment unsealed in Brooklyn federal court names Escobar and his reputed top assassin, Dendeni Munoz Mosquera. Escobar escaped from a Colombian prison last month and remains at large. Munoz is in a U.S. federal prison following conviction in March of lying about his illegal entry to the U.S. If Munoz is convicted of placing the bomb on the plane, he could face the federal death penalty or life in prison. Both he and Escobar also face life sentences if convicted on federal drug, murder, and racketeering charges. The indictment was announced by officials of the Drug Enforcement Administration and U.S. Attorney Andrew Maloney, who said, "We must strike at the head to use whatever legal means possible to bring to justice those responsible for atrocious terrorist acts." For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchcliffe in New York.
South Africa's justice minister said today that the government is willing to discuss a general amnesty for political prisoners. The release of political prisoners is a key demand of the African National Congress, which says the government is holding about 400 people on political charges. The ANC rejected any idea of an amnesty that might include government security forces. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's been a busy week for President Bush and the Republicans. On the eve of the Republican National Convention, President Bush had to fend off charges about whether or not he'd had an extramarital affair with a former aide. And in an interview this week, he said he would stand by his granddaughter if she were pregnant and chose to have an abortion. This puts him at odds with the 92 Republican Party platform. And today, Bush made it official. James Baker would take over Bush's beleaguered presidential campaign. Baker will be White House chief of staff and senior presidential advisor, giving him broad political powers. Michael Duffy has been covering the Bush administration since the last campaign. He is a White House correspondent for Time magazine and co-author of a new book about the Bush presidency called Marching in Place. I asked Michael Duffy how he would characterize Bush's first term in office.
Well, it's clearly been a mixed record. He has been an extraordinary manager of extraordinary events overseas, both in safeguarding American interests during the end of the Cold War and in the beginning of a new period when instability seems to be the enemy he sees most frequently overseas. At home, and this is no mystery, he hasn't applied the same kind of energy, much less interest, in the problems which face the country. And it's that he's paying the price for now in the polls, and it's that which he's trying to address both this week and next week at the convention as he goes forward toward re-election.
Do you think he has just a greater understanding of foreign diplomacy than he does of domestic problems, or that's truly where his interests lie?
Both. When you listen to George Bush speak in a press conference or in a conversation, he almost becomes a different person when talking about foreign policy and domestic policy. He hems and haws and doesn't know how to finish his sentences and has a kind of call-waiting style of talking. When he talks about domestic policy, trying to explain that he understands all four or five sides of an issue and never really making clear what he thinks because he's not really sure. In foreign policy, he is clear, he is concise, he speaks in affirmative statements. He's directed, he's engaged. It's like dealing with two different people. And I think most Americans have seen that now. So it's not just a matter of interest. It's also a matter of just what he's good at.
You write that his policy or his approach to governance is to not make things worse. That's how he rules.
Right. We basically think George Bush is a very conservative man, even more conservative than Ronald Reagan in some ways. You know, a lot of people think Reagan was conservative because he was he was for a bigger defense and he was very much anti-communist, and certainly that qualified him. But Bush's conservatism is far more philosophical. He's almost a conservative in the Edmund Burke sense. He fears change. He doesn't like it. It brings on uncertainties. It brings on instability. And he works at all levels, both at home and abroad, to prevent things from changing very quickly. We call him the warrior for the status quo. I think basically he's an old-fashioned order conservative, the kind of person who thinks things are pretty much fine the way they are now, and if you start tinkering with the way things are, they'll likely get worse, not better.
Well, he now is joining the chorus of other political or presidential contenders saying that he is the agent of change. When he says that, what does he mean? And how do you think he's using those words?
Well, George Bush, I think, as an agent of change, is about as likely as me being a member of the Dream Team. if you remember in 1988, interestingly enough, he said then very much the same thing. He said, "We are the change." It's a an expression he used over and over again. What he meant by that in 1988 was that he was, of course, more moderate politically than Ronald Reagan. He was for a child care bill. He was for a Clean Air Act and other measures that would help the environment. He tried to, of course, pose as a kinder, gentler incarnation of Reagan, and that's what he meant by "We are the change" then. And he, for the most part, followed through on those things. I don't think we should undercut that. But what's happened since is that, having accomplished those things, he basically decided that was all he had to do in the first term in order to get reelected. And several things. We had a recession, and he had an attack on him from the right of the Republican Party in the primaries, and he realized that he couldn't stand pat and get reelected. So he had to kind of refashion himself in this political year as someone who had done battle throughout the first term with the Congress and not gotten his way. He says now he's for change, and the way to get it is to elect him and a Republican Congress.
Bush has been criticized for not having strong convictions. George Will was even quoted in saying that his malapropisms reflect his empty beliefs. You don't agree with that, though. You see him as a man of convictions.
Yeah, I do. I really think that's one place where he takes... It's just what his convictions about aren't what we have come to think of as political convictions. They tend to be far more personal, and it's one of the reasons he's been so popular. He believes in family. He believes in friends. He believes in public service. He believes in a kind of coed sense of the flag, and he has a great deal of belief in personal loyalty. These are really more like values than convictions in our political realm, and it's one of the reasons he's always run so hard on values, because he had them. You know, he's got them in spades, and he's got them in a way that he doesn't have clear convictions on abortion, on taxes, on economic policy, across the whole spectrum. It's been one misunderstood reason for his personal and political success, I think. So I don't really buy the notion that he doesn't have convictions. I just think it's important to understand what they are and how they help him.
But what you're saying is that he may have convictions, but he doesn't have coherent, consistent programs built around those convictions.
No, his don't forget, his political career hasn't been one that's based on legislative service or even as, like Ronald Reagan, a firm belief that, you know, we need to just do two or three things, cut taxes and raise defense spending, and everything will come right. He's someone who has hitched his wagon to a different series of political mentors over the years, starting with Barry Goldwater, then Richard Nixon, then Gerald Ford, and then Ronald Reagan, and who had to fashion or refashion his views in order to fit those various mentors. So the lack of convictions has helped him. It hasn't hurt him. His whole political experience is one of refashioning himself, and that has been obviously successful for him.
You describe the many sides of President Bush, and you say on the one hand he doesn't like confrontation, but on the other hand he's known to be very competitive.
Yeah, he's an extremely competitive man, and it's one of the reasons why I think he may yet win this race. He rises to the fight, and he loves being the underdog. It comes to him naturally. He loves being behind. It brings out the best in him because, well, it's as it like playing tennis. When he's down, he never plays better than when he's down two sets to love. That's when he really is able to dig down deep inside himself and really perform. Until then, he kind of just coasts and takes it easily. So he's a very nice man. He's not at all quick to anger. He's been extremely controlled all week about these Jennifer Fitzgerald allegations. Extremely controlled. You can almost see the steam coming out of his ears, but he has not exploded. And that's both in interviews that have been on TV and have been just done with print reporters.
My guest today on Fresh Air is Michael Duffy, and he is Time Magazine's White House correspondent, and he and Dan Goodgame have co-authored a book about President Bush called Marching in Place, The Status Quo Presidency of George Bush. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air today is Michael Duffy, and he's one of the Time Magazine White House correspondents. Let me pick up on something that you said earlier about Jennifer Fitzgerald, and these were allegations in the New York Post that President Bush had had an affair with Jennifer Fitzgerald. How do you take these allegations, and how do you think the press is reporting on it, and how seriously do you take this story?
I take the story seriously, primarily from a political point of view, in watching him react to it and see how he handles it. I'm taking these questions in reverse order. The press has handled it, I think, very delicately. Most of the big papers haven't fronted the story but have stuck it inside somewhere and kept their distance. Obviously, this couldn't have come at a worse time for him. But what we really learned this week wasn't anything we didn't already. It wasn't already out there in the rumor mill.
And since you've been covering Bush, I assume this is a story that you've been aware of.
Yeah, and most everyone has tried to prove it one time or another, and no one has successfully done it yet, certainly by any reasonable standard of evidence. What happened this week is the New York Post gave considerable space to a story that's been a book that's been out for about a month, in which in one footnote a dead man is quoted as having in an interview with the author's husband, as having said he once helped arrange a tryst between Bush and Fitzgerald in Switzerland.
Well, as a journalist, how do you read that?
Well, now we have dead men talking.
Right.
You know, you have to apply rigorous standards of evidence to things to an event that usually is only witnessed by two people. I mean, this is a subject on which Barbara Bush is a hearsay witness. It's a very difficult thing to prove. Moreover, one of the points we make in the book is Jennifer Fitzgerald was essentially used to be Bush's deputy chief of staff as when he was vice president, and she was a very tough customer. She was his doorkeeper, and she made a lot of enemies, including Jim Baker, because she kept access to the vice president very, very tight. And she has a lot of people in this town who aren't her friends, and it's very difficult to slice when talking to them, to slice the piece of truth from, you know, the resentment. And so it's an interesting story that just won't go away. My hunch is that all this episode has done is simply negate the issue for the Republicans. They can't use that issue against Clinton anymore. It's kind of they both now have a no first use policy.
What do you make of the Republican Party platform? I think it's really fair to say it is a rather conservative platform, maybe even more conservative than the platform of 4 years ago. Are these Bush's ideas? Is this what he really believes in when you look at the platform?
Well, I think the platform writing process is one that the Republicans are using this year to do something they normally don't have to do, which is energize their base. The Buchanan insurgency and the string of mistakes Bush has made politically this year have left the conservative wing of the Republican Party about had it. You know, they're quite capable of sitting on their hands this fall. And the one thing that Rich Bond and the Republican Party don't want to happen is for the conservatives to stay home. They need to keep them in the game. They need them to turn out this fall. You know, the battleground of the 92 race isn't among conservatives, it's among independents. But in the meantime, the Republicans really have to keep conservatives in the game. And that's primarily what's going on in Houston.
So you see this platform as really placating some of the very vocal conservatives that have felt very locked out of the Bush White House and have even called for a different president.
Right. I mean, also, it helps Bush in this case. In as much as he doesn't have a lot he wants to do in a second term, there's no harm in getting on board the conservative agenda now. Least he can say, this is what I'm for, gives him something to be for. So it's something of a twofer for Bush.
And yet, if you look at the issue of abortion and you look at the platform, which basically says that abortion only in the case of saving a woman's life, and then you read the interview between Bush and a reporter about what would happen if his granddaughter got pregnant, and he said basically he would support her choice, how is it as a public, or even how, as a journalist, how do you make sense of those two positions?
Well, it's a classic Bush position. He's trying to both appease conservatives with a platform and reach out to independents, and particularly Republican women in the suburbs, by talking about his quote unquote personal view. This is, you know, a classic case of Bush trying to have it both ways. And what's particularly clear about it is that he's doing it for now because he needs those votes more than ever. We were in the middle of 1990 or 1991. He wouldn't be needing to woo those women or those voters. He needs them, and he needs them now because they're going to make up their mind here in the next 3 to 4 weeks. And so this is it's no coincidence that this that he made those comments this week, and Mrs. Bush made very similar comments.
So he's saying, "Read my lips, don't read my platform."
Right.
But the assumption is that the public then will be more convinced by what he says.
I think the assumption is that everyone will hear what they want to hear, and I don't think it's a whole lot more sophisticated than that. I think the other thing to keep in mind about the abortion issue, particularly as we watch George Bush, is that it once again shows how he does differentiate himself from the rest of the country. He says, if this were my granddaughter or my daughter, I would put my arm around her. And that's what you do for friends and family. And if you really kind of dissect that, what Bush is saying is, if you happen to be a friend or family member of the Bush family, then abortion is a personal choice, and for everyone else, but if you aren't, it's not. And I know that sounds harsh, but in fact, that's essentially it, is that certain people are going to make responsible decisions, and no one else really can be trusted to make those responsible decisions. And I think that his comments about what he would do, though they are intended to have political effect, are an interesting window on the way he looks at the country.
So will James Baker save the Bush presidency?
Well, he won't save the Bush presidency. I think that's already been a failure. I think he will save perhaps the Bush campaign. I think Jim Baker does 3 or 4 things for George Bush which he desperately needs right now. The first thing is that he will come up with an agenda so that Bush can show that he's doing something. Most of the polls, even inside the Bush White House, say that while most Americans don't really disagree with Bush's fundamental ideology, they don't really believe he can do anything anymore, that he can't execute stuff. We're going to see just a blizzard of initiatives over the next couple of weeks, not because Bush really wants to do any of them or intends to do them, to prove that he would do them. And that he can do them. The second thing Baker does is that he's perhaps the only person in the country who can look George Bush in the eye and say, "Shut up, you're veering from the record." Bush is a sloppy campaigner. He can't really stay on a script. His mind wanders, and he's given to saying all the things we know he can say without much warning.
Let me just stop you there. Why is Baker able to do that with Bush? Why is he the only person in the country?
He's not scared to use strong language with the most powerful man on earth, which is tricky to do. It's still intimidating to talk to the president of the United States. It's a trick, and even people who've worked with him for a long time have trouble breaking into candor. And you do have a tendency to say what he wants to hear, and so Baker doesn't have this problem. And he can say to George Bush, "You're screwing up, George."
Hmm.
The third thing Baker does, and this is just as badly needed, is that he'll draw a tight loop around decisions. Right now, there are 30 to 40 people in Washington who can tell you at any moment what the campaign and the White House are up to right now. It's one of the reasons they've been getting so much bad press, is that a lot of people know and a lot of people aren't pleased with it. Baker, who comes over to the White House with his team of 4 or 5 top aides, will draw the loop almost that tight. Instead of 30 people knowing what's going on, it'll be 4 or 5.
So he's really centralizing the power.
Extremely. Then. And leaks will stop, and it'll be harder to make sense of what's going on. It'll be a much tighter ship.
Do you think it's too late?
No, I don't think it's too late. I think he can still win. I think another week or two would have been too late, but I think he still can win a close one. I don't think it'll be a positive campaign at all. I think he'll have to. It'll be very harsh, not just with respect to Clinton, but the fundamental message, which is that we'll be very pessimistic, and it'll come down to Bush saying, "Look, I'm not great, but he's worse." And you can have me, and you know what I am. It's the devil you know versus the devil you don't know.
How do you think the campaign will be in the next couple of months? And I'm wondering even how you compare Dukakis against Clinton and how much those two Democrats are going to change the way Bush is going to campaign.
Well, certainly the Clinton campaign is far more disciplined than the Dukakis campaign was. Clinton has been extraordinary in that he isn't letting Bush get away with these attacks, and he's responding very quickly, sometimes within the hour. And so,
sometimes even in anticipation of.
Yeah, and he's even beat Bush to a couple of punches. So that's something Dukakis never did. So he's shown that he's tough and resilient in a way that Dukakis never did, which I think is an important ingredient for running for president. I think you do have to show the American people that you can take it.
But do you think that toughness will bring out something else in President Bush?
Well, I don't know. I think he's shown that he can if he wants to. I do think the most important thing for him to do is to explain what he wants to do with the second term. So much of what drove the first term was a desire to be reelected, that absent that imperative, it's hard for me to understand what would drive a second term.
You've spent about 4 years of talking with Bush and people that he worked with, and since character seems to be such an issue in this campaign now, are there character issues you think that more character issues which will come out about George Bush? Ones that might cast doubt on who he is?
No, it's interesting. In 1988, George Bush went to New Orleans as a kind of, a warmed-over clone of Ronald Reagan, and everyone wanted to know, who is this guy? What does he think? What's he like? We know what he stands for. He stands for continuity. But we want to know who he is. And so he gave this kinder, gentler speech in which he talked about going to football games and moving to Texas and going to barbecues and hearing the quiet voices. And it was a wow of a speech, and he jumped 8 or 9 points as a result of it. 4 years later, he goes to Houston with a very different challenge. People know who he is. I don't think the American public are very confused about what this guy's like. What they don't know is whether he stands for very much or believes in anything or can do anything. And that's his challenge now. I don't think character is now going to come back and bite George Bush. I think his standard is a lot higher. And it's harder to cobble together convictions and beliefs than it is character. I mean, everybody has some story to tell.
Right.
But coming up with a plan for a nation that I think wants a plan, it's a lot harder.
Michael Duffy, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Michael Duffy is a White House correspondent for Time magazine and co-author of a new book about the Bush presidency called Marching in Place. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wain with Fresh Air. John Cage has been described by the New York Times as a prolific and influential composer whose minimalist works have long been a driving force in the world of music, dance, and art. In addition to traditional instruments, his pieces include the spoken word, typewriters, and the sound of vegetables being chopped. John Cage died yesterday at the age of 79. Coming up, a 1982 interview he recorded with Terry Gross. Also, Ted Koppel, Merv Griffin, Crisco ads, and Big Macs. The new book, American Mythologies, is an analysis of American culture. Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Houston, Republicans have completed work on their 1992 platform. The document is decidedly conservative, angering more moderate members of the party, especially those who support abortion rights. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Houston.
Just as the Democrats move their party toward a more moderate stance on welfare, defense, crime, and foreign policy, Republicans have similarly drafted a document moving their party further to the right. The GOP blueprint blasts the Democrats on every page, blaming them for the stalled economy, an erosion of family values, and a whole host of social evils. The document praises President Bush's arms reduction policies, the invasion of Panama, improving Middle East peace prospects, and his handling of the Persian Gulf War. It quotes Scripture, Ronald Reagan, and Patrick Buchanan. Self-described moderate delegates on the drafting committee said they were outnumbered, and debate largely centered on minor word changes. Those who tried repeatedly to strip the platform of any reference to abortion were outvoted. Their only success was a separate resolution which said the GOP respects diverse views on abortion and other issues. Ann Stone, the chairman of Republicans for Choice, said, "It's like saying you're welcome, but you're really not." I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Houston.
In what was billed as a major foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton has issued a strong indictment of President Bush and his foreign policy. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Los Angeles.
In his speech before the World Affairs Council, Bill Clinton said that President Bush has failed to meet the tests required of the new post-Cold War world order. He said that although he has agreed with the president on a number of foreign policy issues, he believes the president has often failed to stand up for American democratic values.
From the Baltics to Beijing, from Sarajevo to South Africa, time after time, this president has sided with the status quo against democratic change, with familiar tyrants rather than those who would overthrow them, with the old geography of repression rather than a new map of freedom.
Clinton went on to stress that the nation's first foreign priority and its first domestic priority are one and the same, reviving the economy. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
As speculated for weeks, President Bush has called on Secretary of State James Baker to move over to the White House and help run his reelection campaign. In leaving state, Baker takes on the job of White House Chief of Staff, replacing Samuel Skinner, who becomes General Chairman of the Republican National Committee. With Mr. Bush trailing in the polls, Republicans have urged that Baker take an active leadership campaign role, as he did in the past for the president in 1988. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 8 points to close at 3,313.27. This is NPR News. In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved the use of military force as a last resort to make sure that food and medical supplies get to Bosnia. At the same time, diplomats said there are no plans as of now for military intervention. The council also demanded that detention camps be inspected and warned of possible war crimes trials. The UN resolutions were adopted by a vote of 12-0 with 3 abstentions. The Bush administration is continuing to review its options in southern Iraq. In the wake of recent military activity against rebels opposed to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
State Department officials say government forces are on the move in southern Iraq, with Iraqi warplanes sometimes shelling and strafing villages in rebel-held areas. The officials, who spoke on background, said Iraqi troops had been moving into positions where they could prepare attacks against Shiite rebels, but they said new ground attacks do not appear imminent. The Bush administration has been considering proposals to establish a protective zone in southern Iraq to prevent government attacks against Shiite areas. Meanwhile, the officials also said the United Nations economic sanctions against Saddam Hussein's regime have become increasingly effective. They said recent shortages had prompted Saddam Hussein to make new appeals to Iraqis for economic belt tightening. The officials also said that Iraq is finding it more difficult to obtain hard currency to purchase items needed to keep its economy afloat. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In New York, federal law enforcement personnel have charged Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar and another man in connection with a bomb explosion that destroyed a jetliner over Colombia 3 years ago, killing more than 100 people. Escobar escaped last month from his prison in Colombia. Both men were also charged with federal drug, murder, and racketeering counts, which carry potential life sentences. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Avant-garde composer John Cage died yesterday at the age of 79. Cage spent his life challenging our preconceptions about music and art. He began composing in the early 30s when he was influenced by the 12-tone music of Arnold Schoenberg. But by the end of the decade, he was exploring new territories in music. Eventually, his pieces were composed using what he called chance processes. Cage used unconventional instruments like sleigh bells and brake drums from cars. His interests extended well beyond music. He had a long collaboration with choreographer Merce Cunningham and influenced several generations of visual and performance artists. In 1982, Terry Gross had a conversation with John Cage, and we want to play an excerpt of that for you today. First, something from his 1959 work, Indeterminacy. In it, Cage tells 90 stories in 90 minutes, giving 1 minute for each story, no matter what the length of that story is. The piano and electronic music score was composed and realized by David Tudor. Cage and Tudor allow the voice and music to collide, letting the music sometimes drown out the voice.
This summer, I'm going to give a class in mushroom identification at the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's 5 field trips, not really a class at all. However, when I proposed it to Dean Clara Meyer, though she was delighted with the idea, she said, "I'll have to let you know later whether or not we'll give it." So she spoke to the president, who couldn't see why there should be a class in mushrooms at the new school. Next, she spoke to Professor McIver, who lives in Piermont. She said, "What do you think about our having a mushroom class at the new school?" He said, "Fine idea. Nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation." This remark was relayed both to the president and to me. It served to get the class into the catalog and to verbalize for me my present attitude toward music. It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound. They listen only to the relationship between two or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. "Did you hear that?" they will say. In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the botanical gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous amanitas was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the hall moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Köln, in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors. I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer, whose works were being performed, had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount."
That was an excerpt from the John Cage-David Tudor collaboration, Indeterminacy. Cage told Terry Gross about his unconventional approach to composition.
I've never thought that, as many people do, that music should be in my head and that I should learn how to write down what I already hear. I really can't hold a tune, and I don't know solfège at all. So that I've found ways of writing music to produce sounds that I haven't heard and that other people haven't heard. If I'd studied solfège, if I had a feeling for harmony, which I don't, I think I would simply write what people have already heard or what I would have thought I heard. The result is I have a curious feeling every time I write a new piece, particularly one for orchestra that involves so many people and so much trouble, you know, to bring it into existence. I think up until the last minute that maybe it's just going to be a great mistake or that we won't discover anything with it.
So you have to listen to your pieces as they're being done in probably a different way than most composers listen to their
work. I hear them for
work.
The first time, and I hear them with interest rather than critically. I try to hear what there is to hear.
I think when you were studying with Schoenberg, and this is an indirect quote, he said something like, you don't have an ear for harmonies, and that will always be for you like walking against, like knocking into a wall. And you said, in that case, I'll bang my head against
right,
that wall for the rest
right,
of my career.
Right.
And a lot of your work hasn't been about that relationship of sounds to other sounds, but of sounds in and of themselves, individual sound, sound for itself. Is that too, do you think, from not wanting to work with harmony?
I had an interest in each single sound from the beginning. At first, I began putting the sounds together into, as I'd been taught, into motives and repeating them and varying them. But gradually, and through a study of Oriental philosophy, and through the use of chance operations, I have found ways, I think, of letting sounds move from their own centers rather than centers in my mind.
What's your attitude towards random sounds in your home? I'm thinking now of...
I just love them.
Uh-huh, like apartments in Manhattan, which is probably the noisiest city in the world.
I live on, and Sixth Avenue is very, very noisy. And sometimes there's burglar alarms.
Oh, yeah.
And they may last 3 or 4 hours. That's quite a problem. I think that we almost have an instinct to be annoyed by a burglar alarm. But as I pay attention to them, they're curiously, slightly varying.
What if you're paying attention to something else at the same time?
Well, I think that one of our most accessible disciplines now is paying attention to more than one thing at a time. And if we can do that with equanimity, then I would suggest paying attention to 3 things at the same time. And you can practice that as a discipline. I think it's more effective than sitting cross-legged. I mean to say cross-legged in relation
to... In meditation.
Yes. It opens the... I think the meaning of meditation is to open the doors of the ego from a concentration on itself to a flow with all of creation, wouldn't you say? And if we can do this through the sense perceptions, through multiplying the things to which we're able at one and the same time to pay attention, I think we accomplish much the same thing. At least that's my faith.
You're listening to a 1982 interview that Terry Gross did with avant-garde composer John Cage. Cage died yesterday at the age of 79. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1982 interview with composer John Cage.
You've, like, rejected taste and memory in the Chance Prozesi's work. What's restricting about taste and memory for you?
There's a beautiful remark of Marcel Duchamp: to reach the impossibility of transferring from one like object to another the memory imprint. And I think the trouble with memory, both from a poetic point of view, is made clear too by the remark of René Char, the French poet, that each act is virgin, even the repeated one. To see things as being new rather than things that we already know before we're experiencing them. I think this is one of the things that leads to trouble between two people when someone says of another person, I knew what she would say, or I knew what he would say. I would hope that we don't get into that frame of mind with respect to one another.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because you have such a really rich and detailed memory and use it so beautifully in your storytelling and in your writings, which become your pieces also. Mm. I know that memory does come into play.
There's another remark I've come across in the last year or so that I like, and it's by the composer Erik Satie. And it's related to that remark that I just quoted from Char, each act is virgin. Satie says, experience is a form of paralysis. Do you see the relation? If we think we know what the other person is going to say, and if we don't approach things as virgin, then our minds and our attitudes to our life become paralyzed. And that's why we want to have each thing new. To realize that two Coca-Cola bottles are not identical. And what makes them not identical is that they're not at the same point. They can't be at the same point in space. Since they're not at the same point in space, they automatically receive, each one receives light differently than the other, so that it can be as fascinating as going to a museum to look carefully, attentively at two Coca-Cola bottles. And something of that is implicit in a great deal of 20th century art.
That kind of perception, I think, sometimes, like when you walk into a museum or a concert hall, it's like your senses get turned on because you're gonna be paying money, you're walking in, you're going here especially to experience something sensual, whereas when you go to work in the morning or when you're going to take the subway or something, you kind of turn down a lot of those senses. You're not expecting a sensual experience, and you're maybe expecting things that you're not going to want to see or hear too much.
It's marvelous, though, when we are surprised by coincidences of light or sound and our presence. That's one of the beautiful things about hunting mushrooms, is that they grow up and are fresh at just a particular moment. And our lives are actually characterized by moments.
I think your life is like this great dialectic between things like between computers and the I Ching, or between having to know what mushroom to pick so that you don't kill yourself and your friends by doing the poisonous one, and then using chance processes for your music and poetry. Do you consciously decide which each of those will be, or do you just kind of naturally have those interests in
I think we should
sides?
We can tell rather clearly when we're in what the Indians call an artha circumstance, which is a circumstance where you have a goal and you don't want to kill yourself, or you want to win as in a game, or you want to cross the street without getting killed, or you want to hunt wild mushrooms and not kill yourself, and so on. That's one way of living. Another way of living is having and giving pleasure, kama. And another way is following the good rather than the evil.
I think that would, that which is dharma in Indian philosophy is very close to what in Christianity is faith, hope, and charity, such things. And then in Buddhism there is moksha, which is liberation from all those three concerns. And normally if we went to school, we would think, well, we start in artha, we go to kama, we go to dharma, and we graduate and get into moksha. But I think the truth of the matter is that we're in all four all of the time, and that we live a life characterized by inconsistency. And that's the marvelous thing. You can then write a poem, as the Japanese monk did, on having reached enlightenment. You can say, now that I'm enlightened, I'm just as miserable as ever.
I like to think of I like to think
and
of
that characterizes, you know, the way we feel, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and say you get exhausted toward the end of the day, and don't you have the experience of finding life not quite so bad the next morning when you wake up, full of new energy?
That was John Cage talking with Terry Gross from a 1982 interview. John Cage died yesterday at the age of 79. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Robert, how are you going to cover James Baker's new appointment?
Well, we'll have a story about what Mr. Baker said in Washington today and about what's likely to happen to stewardship over foreign policy these next few months. Also, we'll hear a reaction from delegates assembled at the Republican National Convention in Houston. The convention, of course, begins next week, but there are delegates there already working on the platform and other committees. Also, Linda Wertheimer talks today with a group of former and perhaps future Republican voters about what they make of the Bush campaign and the Clinton campaign so far. Also, other news coming up later today about UN action on Yugoslavia.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You may not be aware of it, but every time you try to guess the significance of Madonna's new hair color, you've just become a semiotician. Semiotics is the school of thought that sees art, social behavior, political acts, and other artificial landscapes as signs of unconscious cultural codes. To semioticians like Marshall Blonsky, all the world's a text. In Blonsky's new book, American Mythologies, he decodes all sorts of signs from restaurant interiors to Vanna White. But critic Maureen Corrigan says maybe Blonsky would have been better off sticking to books.
As soon as I read the preface to American Mythologies, I should have known I was sailing into some heavy weather. In the preface, novelist Umberto Eco describes Blonsky's writing style as an intricate French-like English, which in its turn is trying to imitate the German-like French of Lacan. This is supposed to be a compliment. But if you translate Echo's theory speak into plain English, it reads something like this. Warning, do not drive or operate heavy machinery for at least 3 hours after reading this book. To its credit, American Mythologies is one of those ambitious works that tries to interpret just about everything your average earthling might encounter. Blonsky wants nothing less than to decode contemporary America. To accomplish this, he sets out to investigate what he calls the living sources of American myth. His book is crammed full of interviews with the likes of Ted Koppel and Merv Griffin, analyses of the New York subway system and porno movies, and photographs of Giorgio Armani suits, Crisco ads, and Yamaha tape decks. A friend of mine refers to this kind of scholarship that violates disciplinary boundaries as academic imperialism. Unlike its political counterpart, academic imperialism can often be a force for good. Take a McDonald's restaurant, for instance. Blonsky imports foreign semiotic theory to make us see the McDonald's menu in startling new ways. He explains that the taste of the all-meat patty is canceled out by the special sauce, which is canceled out, in turn, by the lettuce, cheese, onions, and sesame seed bun. Voila! There you have the Big Mac as the anti-cheeseburger. Blonsky concludes that we buy products less to eat than to signify. And what a product like the Big Mac signifies is the good, that is, the fast life. But like the imperialists of yore, Blonsky undermines his own occasional good critical deeds. He flaunts his superiority to the people and territories he's conquered. He only munches that lowly Big Mac because duty calls. Ordinarily, Blonsky Sahib would eat steak. In the New York subway chapter, he makes going down into a train station sound like an exotic descent into the heart of darkness, which maybe it is, but hundreds of thousands of ordinary travelers do it every day. And when he needs, for research purposes, to attend a taping of The Price is Right, why, Blonsky just closes his eyes and thinks of England. You get the picture. In his heart, Blonsky is an unreconstructed masterpiece theater fan. He doesn't seem to much like or respect the popular culture artifacts he's collected. If he did, he wouldn't lump Vanna White in with Stephen King, in with Chicken McNuggets. He'd make value distinctions. And he'd write about his subjects in clear English, not in turgid Eurocrit jargon. Culture studies, like American mythologies, are very hot these days. But I wish that unsympathetic scholars like Blonsky would return home and cede the territory to those critics who recognize that they've been contaminated and inspired by the very popular culture they're studying. Critics like Blonsky don't explore popular culture, they colonize it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look forward to the GOP convention that's starting next week in Houston. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you can join us for the next Fresh Air.